Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Center for Science and Culture. The following talk is by Richard Sternberg, a biologist with the Discovery Institute. Dr. Sternberg will be discussing evidence that refutes the myth that the human genome is full of junk DNA. This lecture was recorded at a recent Science and Human Origins conference. Here's Dr. Sternberg.
And at a higher scale, when you look at the folders, they are in turn arranged into superfolders. So what we have here is a hierarchy. It's a hierarchy of organization. You go from, quote unquote, a gene, you go onto the folders that contain them, and then you go onto these superfolders. And you can map the human chromosomes, and what you find is this very interesting linear barcoding of the chromosomes. And this is relevant. And it's relevant because what we have found is that of our DNA sequences, almost all of it is utilized at some point in our development. See, when I started out, and this is what brought me into genetics, most of our DNA was considered as what? Junk DNA. And this junk, it was argued, would have what kind of distribution? What kind of pattern would you expect if, say, 1% to 2% is functional and the rest of it is nothing but garbage? A more or less random distribution, would you not? But when we actually panned out and started looking at chromosomes, what we found out is that the pattern is the exact opposite of randomness. The pattern that you see in the middle, for example, you've got chromosomes, is you get these very nice bands, and these bands reflect at the highest scale this hierarchical distribution. Quite intricate. And in turn, and this just shows you these folders are organized into banding patterns. If you've been in a high school biology class, you may have had to stain chromosomes, look at cells that are dividing. You can see these through a standard microscope. All right. You could take one of your, say, some blood cells, you could prepare the chromosomes, and that's what you would see, is this kind of banding pattern. It's a barcode. My point is that our DNA is ordered into a nested hierarchy of different data files, and here's the interesting thing. When you look at the protein coding sequences that you have in your cells, what you find is that they are nearly identical to the protein coding sequences of a dog, of a carp, of a fruit fly, of a nematode. They're virtually the same, and they are interchangeable. You can knock out a gene that encodes a protein for an inner ear bone in, say, a mouse. This has been done. Yeah, you've knocked it out. And then you can take a protein that's similar to it, but from a fruit fly. And fruit flies aren't vertebrates, and they certainly are not mammals, and therefore they don't have inner ear bones. And you can plug that gene in, and guess what happens? The mouse, or at least the offspring that have it, they have perfectly normal inner ear bones. So you can swap out all these files. I'm mentioning this to you because when you hear about we're 99% similar, it's almost all referring to those protein coding regions. When you start looking, though, and you start comparing different mammals, dolphins, aardvarks, elephants, manatees, humans, chimpanzees, macaque, it doesn't really matter. What you find is that whereas the protein coding sequences are very well conserved, and whereas a lot of the DNA that's not protein coding is also highly conserved, when you look at the chromosomes and those banding patterns, those barcodes, it's akin to going into the grocery store. You see a bunch of black and white lines, right? You've seen one barcode, you've seen them all. But those barcodes are not the same. If they were the same, then, you know, you go and you're, I want green beans, and they say, no, you're buying a wrench or something like that. It doesn't work that way. Here's an example. Aardvark and human chromosomes. They look very similar at the DNA level when you take small snippets of them. When you look at how they're arranged in a linear pattern along a chromosome, they turn out to be very distinct. So when you get to the folder and the superfolder and the higher order level, That's when you find these striking differences. And here's another example. They are now sequencing the nuclear DNA of Terciops truncatus. It's the Atlantic bottlenose dolphin. And when they started initially sequencing the DNA, and this is actually from the late 90s, and now it's a lot cheaper and it's faster, so we're getting a lot more data. But the first thing they realized is what? They said, basically, the dolphin genome is almost wholly identical to the human genome. That is, there are a few chromosome rearrangements here and there. You line the sequences, and they fit very well. Yet no one would argue, based on a statement like that, that bottlenose dolphin, Terciops, is closely related to us, our sister species, if you will. No one would presume to do that. So you would have to layer in some other assumption. But here's just a point. You'll see these statements throughout the literature of how common things are. The significance of this is that when you look at DNA data content, and think of it just like a string of zeros and ones, if you were to be handed, say, the source code for it was a Mac operating system, it's something like 10.6 million lines of source code. If someone just handed it to you, a bunch of zeros and ones and some other things, or you were to look at it at that level, and someone handed you that for, say, some other type of operating system, you would be able to find perhaps areas where zeros and ones would align, would you not? Nevertheless, the information content is very different. No one would think of interconverting, say, a PC and a Macintosh operating system. What you find is something very similar with vertebrates and with mammals, is that when you look at the DNA sequences, the DNA data content, especially the parts lists, the proteins, they're very, very similar. They're shared with almost all mammals. But it's getting to those higher levels and how it is used where you find tremendous differences. So in part, why we are not chimps or dolphins or aardvarks or elephants is that the protein coding data that people have been focused on since the 1950s really comprises 1.5% of our DNA. When you get out of that 1.5% DNA, particularly when you go to that 50% of your DNA that largely consists of these virus-like sequences, it's a completely different story, and also how they're arranged. Most of your DNA, most of your dog's DNA or your cat's DNA, like I said, roughly half, breaks down into various types, families of sequences that are interesting because they are mobile. They can jump around. In fact, when they were first discovered, they were called jumping genes. You can observe them in bacteria, you can observe them in yeast, you can observe them in fruit flies, you can observe them in human populations of changing, if not internally, at least in position. It's the basis, for example, of DNA fingerprinting, how you can tell one individual from another. They focus on those areas that change from one generation to the other. Well, the lion's share of them are located in families that are called lines, that are called signs, that are called retroviral-like elements, and then DNA elements. You don't need to remember the terms, but half of your DNA in any given cell consists of sequences that can do a number of amazing things. And these sequences were considered just junk. No more, but they were up until just a few years ago. And I'm going to skip this part. You don't need to understand the functional organization. But what you do need to know is that if you look at chimps and humans and you buy into the story that we are only separated from them by about 5.5 million years, that is, if you assume common ancestry for the sake of argument, what you will find is that there are a number of different families of these jumping, moving around DNA sequences that are chimpanzee-specific and not found in human, or that are human-specific and not found in chimpanzee. And almost all these sequences are now known to be playing very important roles in terms of how genes are switched on and off. Think of it like these are components of your computer. You've added some things to your hard drive. You have it, and you may have the latest version, and someone else doesn't have anything comparable to that. It's a similar thing we have between humans and chimpanzees. And I pointed out, when you look at the layout of a mammalian gene, you've got this hierarchical, multi-leveled organization. And what we find is that these human-specific elements are actually forming the demarcation points, the boundaries of where these folders start and where they don't start. An example that I would give that you probably could relate to, if you've ever worked in a large office place, what you'll often find is what I would call cubopolis. There are cubicles everywhere. You've seen them, haven't you? And the interesting thing about what do the cubicles do? Well, you can pick them up, you can move them around, you can change it, you can expand or contract, right? It's a very malleable floor plan. And it turns out that these jumping genes, these human-specific jumping genes, they're like the partitions between cubicles. They're the ones that are setting up and they're saying, okay, within this region here, you've got your file. And we're going to name your file for you. So when you want to retrieve this file, you go looking for us. And then you click on us, we'll expand it, and then you can retrieve your data. So when you look at this, here it was the example of this hemoglobin gene region. You've got these so-called MAR sequences. These are the folding points where they're brought together. And that, again, consists of mainly these jumping gene groups, consists of mainly sequences that are species-specific, and these are the sequences that are integral to the computation that's occurring in your cell. So, my point is that the junk fraction, the largely species-specific fraction, the fraction that is not really taken into account when you hear the, oh yes, we're 99% chimpanzee. Well, not really. No more so than saying that, say, a Macintosh is 99% PC or something like that. Or if you break apart, say, different cell phones and say, I can find all these parts that are in common. You could do that, right? But the fact is, how they're arranged, how they're put together, and how they're used are strikingly different. So it wouldn't matter. Wouldn't matter in a way if indeed we were 99% DNA sequence similar to it, because just having these markers that are species specific already makes a difference in how you can use the DNA.
This lecture was recorded at a Science and Human Origins conference in the fall of 2014. The conference featured John West, Casey Luskin, Ann Gager, and Rick Sternberg, talking about the fossil, genetic, and social issues surrounding the debate over human origins. We will be featuring these speakers on future episodes of ID the Future. For more information, please visit idthefuture.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.